I find myself at a loss for words. I come to a sermon like this, Ascending God, and I find myself at a loss of words, which is kind of weird for me. It really is. I mean, John is my favorite apostle, but Peter and I have a lot more in common. We have big, fat mouths. We just do. And yet I come to a sermon like this, and I find myself at a loss for words. Throughout my entire academic career, my mouth has always been the problem. Always. Even when I was in elementary school. Man, I would get straight A's on my report cards, and there would always be some little comment like, likes to chatter, or talks too much, or has a big fat mouth. No, but you get the point. I've never had a problem with saying anything, always having something to say, and yet I come to a sermon like this. And I find myself at a loss for words. Even in junior high and high school, my goodness, my mouth was always what got me in trouble. I was actually a pretty good kid. And it wasn't because I was afraid to get in trouble or I was just one of those goody two shoes. Honestly, you wanna know what the reality was? I saw all the things my friends were doing and I just didn't understand logically the cost reward. I just was like, I don't understand how it makes sense to be an idiot. It didn't ever really make sense to me. But if I did get into trouble, you could trace it back to one key element. My mouth. Thank you. Audience participation, that's delightful. My mouth. Whether it was after school detention or getting grounded at home, always my big fat mouth. I always had something to say. But I come to a sermon like this, and I find myself at a loss for words. You would think after I went all the way through undergrad here at Ozark and I made it to the master's program at Lincoln, I would have had my mouth problem figured out. And what I decided to do was I made a vow to myself. I said, I will not speak a word in class. Through my whole master's program, I wasn't going to speak a word. And I actually kept that commitment my whole first year until the last 3 or 4 weeks of class. Ugh. I'm sitting in Dr. Gary Hall's Hebrew class. And we just got done translating some Deuteronomy text, and he was talking about Hebrew syntax, and he was trying to make it easier for us. And he said, you have to understand that what we're dealing with in this verse is very similar to Greek grammar. He says, whatever language we're dealing with. English grammar. He says in English, what do you call it in a sentence whenever you have an aside or an editorial comment that we usually bracket off with two commas? And the class sat for like 15 to 30 to 45 seconds and no one said anything. But I knew the answer. And so against my better judgment, I said under my breath, I said, well, it's in a positive. He said, who said that? I was like, oh, geez. Well, Mr. Wood, you're exactly right. It's in a positive. He said, where did you learn that? Oh, and here's where it happened. I wasn't thinking. I just said, second grade English class. And the guy next to me is like, ooh, Mr. Smartman, second grade English class. And then the rest of the class with a collective groan, oh, second grade. I was like, no, I just had a really good English teacher in second grade. Like, my big fat mouth always gets me into trouble. I always have something to say. But I come to a sermon like this, and I find myself at a loss for words, which is kind of strange. I mean, they gave me the sermon at the end of the year that's the rah-rah sermon, where my whole job is to literally just compel you into the extended week of E that we call the summer. That's my whole job, is to get you excited about sharing the message of Jesus, about going to the ends of the earth, about making him famous. A monkey could preach this sermon. But I find myself at a loss of words. Frankly, I just don't even know what to say. I don't even know what I am supposed to say. And really, there's two reasons why the words of this sermon are so hard for me to come up with. First reason is this. I don't know where you're being sent. I have no idea. I would love to be able to stand up here to say and to look at you and say, you know where you're being sent? You're being sent to a summer that is full of evangelistic victories, that's full of dozens and dozens of baptisms, that's full of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, that is so powerful that it may even challenge some of your theology. But I can't. Because for some of you, you're being sent to a summer of frustration. Some of you will find that where you're being sent is to rejection, or maybe even tragedy. I mean, my goodness, if last summer taught me anything, I don't know where you're being sent. I don't know what tomorrow will even look like for you, more or less 12 days from now. Because some of you will experience deep rest while others will experience exhaustion. And some of you will experience new beginnings while others of you will experience abrupt endings. Some of you will experience new life while others will experience death. I am at a loss for words because I don't know where you're being sent. But that's not the main reason why I find myself at a loss for words with a sermon like this. It's not the main reason why I'm having a hard time formulating what to say. It's not the main reason why I'm having a hard time even coming up with what to say to you. The reason why I have a hard time with this sermon, if I'm being honest, which it's not to say that I haven't been so far, but if I can be frank, the concept of the sending God kind of annoys me. It frustrates me. Because in a context like this, we are absolutely obsessed with where we are being sent. We even use it as a competition amongst us for who is being sent to the more exotic place. I'll wear it like a badge on my chest so that you will know that my commission is better than yours. I don't really want to talk about this. Because I don't know how you're going to use this sermon. And usually there's two primary camps. Two camps of thought when it comes to measuring the spiritual greatness of your sending. The first camp I refer to as rock star Christianity. Rock star Christianity. In rock star Christianity, God is only moving, God is only calling, He is only sending if it is to places that are higher up on the Christian corporate ladder. Rock star Christianity. These people, they will go to smaller churches, but it's just so they can prepare for the real work when inevitably that mega church calls. Rockstar Christianity, the pasture is always greener on the other side. They're always looking for that opportunity, that stepping stone where they can ascend to the coveted status of rockstar, all the while blaming every one of their moves on the Holy Spirit. You know what I'm talking about. It surfaces in conversations about your internships or about your plans for after graduation, where what they read will outshine everyone else. My word, sometimes rockstar Christianity even determines who you'll be friends with and who you won't be friends with. I've found two things to be true about rockstar Christianity. Number one, they have an unhealthy and a dangerous addiction to pleasure. And number two, they are never satisfied with their calling. But over here is the other camp, where they measure spiritual greatness of their sending in a little bit of a different manner. This camp I call Messiah Complex Christianity. Messiah Complex Christianity. In Messiah complex Christianity, God is only moving, he is only calling, he is only sending if it's to a place that is comparable to hell itself. For in this camp, the calling of God is equivalent to being the whipping boy of God. For you can measure the greatness or the success of your ministry with how much pleasure you reject or how much you sacrifice for the sake of the call. In this camp, they will look for hardships. They will look for obscurity. They will look to even hang on the cross that their Messiah is supposed to be hanging on. They will look for opportunities to hang themselves on the cross they were called to carry. They look for opportunities to hang on the cross, look down at their nose at all the other Christians that have it easier than they do. You know what I'm talking about. Messiah complex Christianity usually surfaces in conversations about how busy your schedule is. Because whoever violates the Sabbath the most must be the more devoted follower of Jesus Christ. I've learned two things about Messiah complex Christianity. Number one, they have an unhealthy addiction, a dangerous addiction to pain. Number two, they are never satisfied with their calling. And so, I find myself at a loss for words. Because I know almost whatever I say, whatever camp you're in, you will use whatever I say to feed your addiction, whether it's to pleasure or pain. And frankly, I don't want to contribute to either one. Because both extremes are damaging to the kingdom of God. Both extremes are damaging to the call of Jesus Christ. Both extremes are damaging even to the very text that this whole sermon is based on. Ezekiel chapters 1 through 3. You can turn there if you want. It's always a good thing. Just ask Berea. Ezekiel chapters 1 through 3. If I was interpreting this text from the rock star Christianity's perspective, if I was interpreting it through their eyes, my eyes would immediately go to Ezekiel chapter 2 verses 1 to 2. No question. Let's read it. God said to Ezekiel, he said to me, Son of man, stand up on your feet and I will speak to you. As he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet, and I heard him speaking to me. Did you notice it? The rock star Christian will say. Did you notice it? Four times in two verses, it emphasizes that God spoke to Ezekiel. Four times. Let's read it again. He said to me, Son of man, stand on your feet and I will speak to you. As he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet and I heard him speaking to me. God spoke to Ezekiel. Ezekiel, living in a land of exile, like many other Jews, had been taken captive by Babylon. And in this time of exile, there's a lot of questions that naturally would be coming to their minds. Has God abandoned us? I mean, what about the promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob? Has he abandoned us? Has he turned his back on his people? We're crying out to him, but can he even hear us? And in this context, God spoke to Ezekiel. He spoke to him. He said, Ezekiel, you will be my prophet. You will be my mouthpiece. As a matter of fact, you will even eat the very message. And in chapter 3, verse 3, Ezekiel eats the scroll from God and he says, it tastes as sweet as honey. And this sends Ezekiel on an amazing ride of incredible visions that ends in chapter 48 with seeing a vision of the restoration of Israel. Ezekiel is a rock star. Are you kidding me? I mean, wouldn't you love to have that on your resume? I got a Bible for Christmas. God spoke to me, gave me visions, ate his book, tastes really good. Ezekiel's a rock star. I mean, he even has a book of the Bible named after him. Not even Jesus has that. Not that we're in competition or anything. And before the rock star Christian can even finish, the Messiah complex Christian starts to retort. He says, but did you read verse 3 of chapter 2? I mean, if you read verse 3 of chapter 2, I don't think Ezekiel is much of a rock star. Verse 3 says this. He said, Son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites. Cool. To a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have been in revolt against me to this very day. Delightful. From the Messiah complex Christian's perspective, the calling of Ezekiel just gets worse and worse and worse. They say it's not just their rebellious people, but chapter 3, verse 7 says this, but the house of Israel will not even listen to you because they're not even willing to listen to you because they're not willing to listen to me. For the whole house of Israel is hardened and obstinate. And if that's not bad enough, chapter 4 through chapter 24 is Ezekiel being commissioned by God to pronounce judgment on a people that are already in exile. Awesome. And if that's not bad enough, he's even called to enact these pronouncements by, you know, things like laying on your side for 390 days and then flipping to the other side for another 40 days, all the while being tied by cords and cooking his food over human excrement. But to be fair, chapter 4, verse 14, Ezekiel does talk God out of the human excrement thing and gets reduced down to the excrement of cows. Delightful. A rock star? No. If anyone knows how to carry his cross, it's Ezekiel. Because Ezekiel understands that all of God's callings leads to pain. And so the story goes. So the dialogue goes of this concept of ascending God. For you have this group of Christians over here, regardless of what the text says. They will find a God. They will look for the bright lights of the Christian community that leads to more money, fame, and pleasure. And then over here, you have this group of Christians, regardless of what the text says. They will look for the gloomy chains of Christianity that always leads to misery, poverty, and pain. But the truth is this. Both extremes are damaging to the text. Both extremes distort the text. Both extremes pervert the call. Both extremes miss the stinking point. They miss it completely. What we have to understand is that the concept of sending has very little to do with the destination, has very little to do with where you end up, has very little to do with where you're going at all. Matter of fact, has very little to do with you at all. For while we are obsessed with the question of where, the scriptures are crying out for us to be obsessed with the question of who. See, it's not an accident that the book of Ezekiel doesn't begin with chapters 2 or 3. It's not an accident that Ezekiel chapter 1 is how the book begins. Ezekiel chapter 1 defines for us the key focus of not just that chapter, but of the entire book. Ezekiel chapter 1 begins in verses 1 through 3 and introduces us to Ezekiel, an exile by the river of Kabar, who is also referred to as a priest or one that has the hand of God upon him. And it's tempting to think that this text is all about him. But it's not. When you get to verse 4, there's a violent windstorm that comes with brilliant flashes and the flashes of lightning. And then it starts to describe for the next 20 verses the four living creatures in such intricate detail. And it's tempting to think that this text is about them. But it's not. Chapter 1, verse 25 shows us where all this text has been building and upon which all the rest of the text will be built upon. Then there came a voice from above the expanse over the four living creatures' heads as they stood with lowered wings. Above the expanse over their heads was what looked like a throne of sapphire, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And then from there down, he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of the one who was speaking. More important than the question of where is the question of who. More important than the question of where you are going is the question of who is the one that is sending you. You see, it's not on accident that in chapters 2 and 3, a phrase is repeated over and over. Over and over, this phrase is repeated. The sovereign Lord. Chapter 2, verse 4, it says, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Chapter 3, verse 11, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Chapter 3, verse 27, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In fact, in the 48 chapters of Ezekiel, the word sovereign Lord appear 217 times. Which leads me to a really simple point. Your sending has very little to do with your pleasure. Your sending has very little to do with your pain. Your sending has very little to do with you at all. For if after 217 times you don't understand that your sending's more about him than it is about you, you're not listening. You're just not listening. You see, the danger of rock star Christianity and the danger of Messiah complex Christianity is not just that it puts you in the center of your theology, although that is abominable. The danger of both of these extremes is that it distorts the identity of the sovereign Lord. For God is not your cosmic Santa Claus in the sky that gives you whatever you want just as long as you act the right way. Any more than he is this sadistic tyrant that has more power than what is really good for you or him. The sovereign Lord is a cleansing God. The sovereign Lord is a powerful God. The sovereign Lord is a humorous God. The sovereign Lord is a ruling God. And your goal is not to become the senior minister of a mega church. Your goal is not to be living on the streets of Philly as part of the simple way. Your goal is not to be on the bright lights of CIY. Your goal is not to be a professor of Ozark Christian College. God help us. Your goal is to intimately and passionately know the identity of who. Because if you don't understand the words sovereign Lord, you will never understand what the word go even means. In other words, you don't know who God is, you will never understand the meaning of these words. You are dismissed.